This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky. You can join our conversation, as always, on our website, wnpr.org/thewheelhouse. You can also find us on Twitter at WNPR Wheelhouse, and today on Facebook Live at WNPR Wheelhouse. It's our first time in a long time we're doing the Facebook Live thing, so you can watch along if you'd like. You can comment. You can like us, if you will.
Hi, Mr. Zuckerberg.
You can also call us at 860-275-7266. Actually, Mark's going to be checking in throughout the course of the program just to see how we're doing with Colin McEnroe. He's the host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Hi there, Colin.
The reason we're doing this Facebook Live thing is to impress Taylor Swift.
Oh, that's
the reason I do everything.
That's the reason you do everything.
Including the crimes I commit.
I hope she's watching. Liz Karanowicz is here. She's a Republican political analyst. Hello there, Liz.
Good morning.
And Dan Haar. He's an editor and columnist at Hearst Connecticut Media. Hello there, Dan.
Good morning. Great to be here.
So we're going to start with the governor's race, and I suppose we should start on the Republican side, where at least five candidates, eight claim to, have raised the $250,000 or more in small donor contributions, the amount needed to qualify for $1.25 million in public funding grants. That's one part of the story. The other part of the story is the Republican Governors Association, Colin, seems to be taking this more seriously. They say they're setting aside $1.7 million for television ads in the race. Where do you want to start? With these candidates, or you want to start with the RGA getting excited about putting a Republican governor in place?
Well, first of all, I feel when there's more candidates than there are dwarves, that's too many. Like, it's hard enough to remember who all the seven dwarves are, whether we're talking about the 88 Democratic field or the actual seven dwarves. I will say, I'm assuming that people, even if they're sort of stretching the truth about their fundraising, I actually think that there are eight candidates who will achieve the necessary fundraising for the Citizens Election Program. How many of those people can make it out of the convention? I mean, they can't all get 15% of the convention.
No.
That's a mathematical
question.
We know that.
Yeah. Yes, they can. Multiple ballots.
Well, it depends on what kind of rules they use.
Well, but unless there's drop rules and things like that.
We'll get into all those rules
later. So, I mean, there's just too damn many of them. And if I were the Republican Governors Association, I mean, that would concern me a little bit. But actually, I'll start there, okay? There's two ways to look at this election in a kind of uber meta way. One of them is that you've got you get a blue tide nationally, and you know, even though the, you know, Ned Lamont or whoever is the nominee, and maybe he's not the most exciting gubernatorial nominee. In fact, I can guarantee you he will not be the most exciting gubernatorial nominee ever.
More on that later.
Right, but you know, and so that just there's a tide and it lifts that boat, you know, and that's kind of how that goes. In which case, you know, a million plus is not money well spent here. Now, the other version of this is that this is a very local race in a lot of ways, and people are very unhappy with Democratic leadership. They're unhappy with Malloy. Of course, he's not running this time, but they're unhappy with that. And there's just sort of a stink kind of hovering over the entire Connecticut political process. People are looking for change, any kind of change. And they decide that to get real change, you need a Republican governor, in which case, you know, then you want to spend every dime that you can making that happen. I don't honestly know which one of those scenarios is true. I mean, either one of them seems kind of plausible.
Well, so the RGA piece of this first, they didn't actually set, you know, make an actual payment, right?
No. So they reserved
time,
yeah.
Which means that they also reserve the right to not purchase that time. They also reserve the right to and make a greater investment. You know, just in full disclosure, in 2014, I ran an independent expenditure PAC called Grow Connecticut. RGA invested nearly $6 million in my effort, and we made a similar reservation, a pre-buy, and it's really to sort of lock in some pricing. But it's also a signal to lots of folks who are interested in the race that you're serious about the race. So, we did in late August, and it was a buy that went through. It was about $5 million reservation of time that went through the election. They've reserved 6 weeks worth of time. But, you know, look, so on the RGA thing, they're you know, signaling to folks in the RGA world. They're signaling to folks in Connecticut, to candidates. They're telegraphing that this is an important race for them, but the candidates have to be electable, well, and the race has to be competitive. So,
and that's the thing. I mean, just reading an update to that story from Mark Pazniokas in the Connecticut Mirror, that whole electable thing. So the GOP nominee has to be electable. What exactly does that mean?
Well, electability is a few things. I mean, you know, we've had trouble, you know, coming out of bitter primaries, both at the governor level and at the congressional level. That's going to have an impact. And I think, you know, the candidate being competitive, they're going to look at polling. They're going to look at voter IDs. They're going to look at all kinds of different factors to tell them, you know, kind of where this race is. One thing they don't have to worry about potentially is the funding, which gets to that other question. I think the interesting point about the fundraising conversation is I came from the world of raising money the old-fashioned way, right? I did Jody Rell's fundraising back in 2006. We raised it the old-fashioned way, raised $4.1 million. And the money that you raised, it was a part of the greater conversation about building a winning coalition. Now, because of public financing, everybody gets the same amount of money, and getting to that magical threshold seems to be a barrier to entry. But the reality is all of these candidates are going to hit that number. Aaron Stewart is just about halfway there. If she gets 15% at the convention and goes to a primary, guess what? She's going to get that money. And another reminder is, like, Tom Foley didn't have hadn't reached the qualifying threshold by the convention. John McKinney hadn't reached the qualifying threshold by the convention. So I think the assumption is that if you are competitive at the convention, you're going to hit the threshold. Everybody's going to hit the threshold.
It's the reservation exemption is the Lumage exemption. In case Peter Lumage wins, he doesn't get any. Guess what? He doesn't get any money because he's, in my opinion, a fringe personality. In any case, I want to give a number, and the number is 21.
Okay.
And the number applies twice here. Number one, 21,000 votes is likely to win the Republican nomination. In the primary, given Liz is sort of shaking.
Yeah, no. The only reason I say that I sort of grimace at that is because, you know, you have to think about from the. Yes, it's in mid-August, and generally speaking, you know, you get about 100,000 votes. But if you've got folks like, you know, for example, if David Stemmerman goes out and collects the signatures, and he's got, you know, an ability to go and really use his money to bring out new voters, or Peter Lumage goes out and creates new Republicans, or Prasad Srinivasan is out in the race and creates new Republicans, those numbers can drive up. So I'm not quite sure yet that's the winning number.
Why the point I'm giving is
because the Republicans are losing control of who is going to be their nominee as a result of exactly what Liz just said. And that's the nightmare scenario for the Republicans, for J.R. Romano. They want Boughton to be their nominee. They can say anything they want. They want Boughton to be their nominee. He's the guy who can win. He's the guy that is going to take the center against a likely candidacy.
You've got a live Republican
I don't know that that's true. And okay, Republicans
but wait,
are
wait,
actually
Let me finish
in,
the point. Like, let me finish the point. So the point is that a relatively small number, whether it's 21 or 24, is going to win. And a person can attract that number, as you said. The second 21 is $21 million. $21 million at least is the amount that's going to be spent on this race. Seven, seven, and seven. $7 million from each candidate citizens election program and $7 million of outside money. That means that the 1.7 relatively ineffectively that the Republican Party is going to spend in broadcast TV, which doesn't reach a lot of people, is a smaller bit than it would have been in years past. Now it's really much more about the ground game on both sides.
A quick comment, and then I want to hear from Colin.
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, first of all, Republicans are very much in control of who the nominee is going to be because Republicans are the only ones that can vote in a primary. So, I think to say that Republicans aren't in control of that process is
I think he means
is
the
not,
Republican
well,
Party.
Okay, that's fine. But to my understanding, I mean, I've been at every one of these debates, and I hear from people all day, every day, because I'm not with a candidate. I'm sort of an observer of this process. I don't know that they have the establishment has a pick. I mean, I think you've got a healthy conversation about that. Mayor Boughton, I would argue, is the front runner in the convention process. He's certainly amassed the most amount of delegates so far, but Tim Herbst not too far behind. Aaron Stewart making a run for it. And then you've got some other candidates that are going to try and hit that 15% threshold. So it'll be interesting to see how it goes. But I honestly don't think that there is a favorite per se of the establishment. I think our problem is that so much of the party stalwarts have a horse in the race, and that's why we don't have a coalition behind one candidate per se.
Yeah, I'm going to agree and disagree with both of my fellow panelists in various ways. I think Liz is right. What she just said is right, which is that I don't think Boughton is a consensus favorite. And I think there are an awful lot of people who there are Republicans who think Boughton has kind of a glass jaw, you know, that he won't run all that well. There are, and as Liz says, there are people who are well placed Republicans who have somebody else that they really like a lot. But I think Dan is right, too, in the sense that when you have this multiplicity of candidates and they all have certain constituencies and well-placed backers, most of them, except for the ones who are not going to, you know, Stemmerman and Stefanowski are not going to run with public grants, most of them are going to have at least some significant amount of money to run a primary because they're all going to qualify, as Liz says. So you get a messy situation where really you could wind up with a candidate that a lot of Republicans aren't super comfortable with. And then the other problem with the way that we do primaries on both sides in this state, but it's especially a primary problem for the Republicans, is that's a small number of people anyway. You know, in terms of registered Republicans are sort of the smallest political group of the three significant political groups in Connecticut. So you could wind up with a nominee who is really kind of a boutique pick, as opposed to
that's
somebody
a fancy
with,
way of saying it.
somebody with really, you know, who can elicit widespread support. I mean, that is a danger.
So how exactly, I mean, we mentioned this earlier. I'll go to Danny on this. How do you thin out this crowd if you you need to get the 15% of the convention? You're talking about multiple ballots. We're talking about eight people or more who are able to qualify for citizens' election funding. I mean, how does this field start to be condensed?
The nightmare scenario for Republicans is it doesn't, and that you have the two self-funded candidates and three coming out of the convention for a total of five in the primary, which is not what you want to see. And the person who emerges from that emerges relatively weak. The strong scenario is I continue to think Boughton could get a look, Liz is a lot more close to this than I am. The bottom line is from the people I'm talking to, they seem to think Boughton is amassing enough to get a majority on the second ballot in the convention. And if that happens, then that gives him a lot of strength going into both the primary and the general election.
Well, it's a little bit of both. So first of all, not all the candidates that quote unquote qualify financially for their grant will actually get a grant. So it's a two-step process. You have to raise the $250,000, but you also have to qualify to be on the ballot in the primary. So there are candidates who have sort of hit the first threshold who will most likely not hit that second threshold. So they won't get a grant for the primary unless they actually qualify to be on the ballot. So my sense is we'll probably end up with five or six candidates in a primary. As a Republican, I don't think that there is a nightmare scenario. I think, you know, in this process, you know, let's say David Stemmerman or Bob Stefanowski, if they participate in the primary, it does make everybody better, stronger, and you get you sort of get your grassroots working and engaged. So,
but if you get back to those raw numbers that Dan and Colin were just talking about, I mean, you end up with a situation which you have five or six candidates,
I think that's
100,000 total votes, and you really have incredibly small margins. That's not, if not a nightmare scenario, Liz, it's not a little bit of a headache and a worry.
I mean,
for the
look,
party?
Is it the way that we would want it to go? Yeah. No. Is it the reality that we're living in? Yes. Sometimes you have to make the best of that reality. But I think that you know, you talk about certainly Mayor Boughton is. You know, if he comes through and wins the convention, he gets the top billing in the primary. That's worth probably 3 to 5 points.
Yeah,
you know, it's interesting. If we come out, some people are saying, we're going to have a brokered convention. We're not going to have an endorsed candidate. Guess what? If that happens, Mark Boughton is the first one on the ballot in the primary because it goes by alphabetical order.
Either way,
Mark Boughton's at the top.
I mean, one way that you can get rid of a multiplicity of candidates in some situations is begin trading out positions. That wouldn't shock anybody to find Aaron Stewart running on the second line at lieutenant governor. But there, one of the problems here is there's a little bit of a logjam in some of those other spots. For example, there are a number of, you know, solid Republican candidates for attorney general. So it's not like you can take somebody who's a lawyer. First of all, you have to figure out whether they qualify or not.
The Bisowitz rule.
The Bisowitz rule. But I mean, so you'll see some of that anyway. Like, could you get somebody out of the gubernatorial race by putting them somewhere else. And
no.
I still
Remember, Republicans go last.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry. The governor goes last.
They haven't established that. I don't believe they've established that yet. That's part of the rules process. But look, I mean, there's also this funny thing called the switches. So the first round of balloting is actually two votes. So if you're a candidate, you know, there are some folks who won't get, you know, maybe 1 or 2% in the first round of voting. Those delegates can say, you know what, we did our bit, we supported our candidate, but now we're going to go vote and have our vote matter. So they switch before the end of the first balloting. So there's actually two rounds per round. And I think, you know, this thing is going to be competitive, and I think there are going to be a lot of candidates that are going to surprise you. The deal making becomes more difficult, though, because of the fact that you've got these public financing grants that are going to under-ticket races. So, you know, for example, in 2014, there couldn't be any deals made for lieutenant governor, for example, because that competition was already so hot. So I don't know that there's – what's interesting to me is that Democrats don't have any candidates running for lieutenant governor.
Well,
right?
We're going to talk about Democrats when we come back from our break. I'll just say that if we are worried at all about people not being civically engaged and worried about whether or not their votes matter and how many people are going to turn out the polls in a midterm election or certainly in August for a primary, just sitting and listening to the way conventions are run, I think would drain the notion out of anybody's mind that they should get involved in politics at all. I will say it seems like a dirty business. Dan, very quickly, we were going to talk about another Republican who might get into the race, Jim Smith, who is heading up this Commission on Fiscal Stability and Economic Development. We heard for like a minute that he's going to run, former head of Webster Bank. Now he's not going to run.
Less than a week. He considered a run. He announced last night that he is not going to run, not because he didn't think he could have the time and the ability to differentiate himself, but because the rule is one interpretation of the rule is that he couldn't have gone to the convention as a Republican because he needed 3-month waiting period after switching parties. He was an independent, and therefore he doesn't want to fight that rule, even though my reading of it is he could have won.
Mm. We'll all remember the Jim Smith era, obviously, in politics. He had great name recognition. I mean, who doesn't know somebody named Jim Smith? And it seems to me if he had T-shirts printed up, there's going to be somebody else running for governor somewhere named Jim Smith.
Jim Smith, you could just
I don't know.
Draft
I have anything
off
else
of
to
him.
Say about this.
Colin McEnroe, host on the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. Dan Haar from Hearst, Connecticut Media. Liz Karanowitz, who's a Republican political analyst.
Wasn't even a Scaramucci.
We will turn.
He didn't even have a full Scaramucci.
My
husband told me that Karanowitz is like Smith in Poland, so I don't know.
Okay. We'll come back and we'll talk about the Democrats who are entering the race for governor and a lot more in the wheelhouse. Turn that off, Danny. Oh. This is the Wheelhouse. I'm John DeKosky.
Where that was coming from.
You can join the conversation at WNPR.org/The Wheelhouse, or as Dan Haar, our panelist, is just finding out, you can also find us live on Facebook Live right now. He's actually watching himself at a 40-second delay.
Okay.
In about 40 seconds, Dan, you're going to hear me to tell you to shut the thing off.
Okay.
You can also call us 860-275-7266. As mentioned, Dan Haar is here from Hearst, Connecticut Media. He is an editor and columnist. Liz Smith, or Karanowitz, a Republican political analyst for those watching in Poland. And Colin McEnroe is here, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. What's on your show today, Colin?
This will really appall Liz, but we're doing it. In fact, one of the reasons we're doing this show just to see if we can get a kind of lively conversation going. But you think about all the things that you need a license to do. Yeah, I mean, be a plumber, be an electrician, run
haircut.
A daycare center, haircut, restaurants, all this stuff. But the most important thing in the world that you do is be a parent, and you don't have to get a license to do that. You don't have to get any training to do it. You just get to do it. So we're going to talk about we have somebody on who's written kind of a semi-futuristic novel about a world in which you have to get a license, and we're going to kind of use that as a jumping-off point.
Oh.
Talk about some of the latent assumptions we have. I mean, we're not seriously proposing that you need a parenting license.
Don't give regulators any kinds of ideas.
I just want to quickly say also, more apropos of the conversation we're having here on Thursday night as part of my World April tour, I'll be with Matt Taibbi at the Mark Twain House, and I think there's some tickets you can still buy.
Oh, very nice. You can check that out at Mark Twain House website. Lots going on with Colin McEnroe. Lots going going on with us here. We talked about Republicans getting into the governor's race. Talk about some Democrats right now. I'll go to you first, Danny. Let's talk about Joe Ganim. We mentioned the candidates on the Republican side who are qualifying for the Citizens Election Fund. As we know, because of Joe Ganim's past, he is not eligible to partake in that. But he says he's raised more than $500,000 so far, as Liz would say, the old-fashioned way.
It's not good. Yeah, well, unfortunately, because it's hard in finance, as we know from the bond markets, as well as in politics, it's hard to compete with the state. And so we're not getting into that.
Or the casino.
Or the casino. It's right. It's hard to compete with the state. It's, you know, if he's very, very good and lucky and wins the primary, he'll raise, you know, $3 or $4 million, but that may not still be enough. I had thought that he was going to appeal the ruling if he were to somehow win the primary, right, and say in the general election by virtue of the fact that I'm the chosen candidate, and I'm hearing that he's not going to do that, that's not the plan. And in fact, he won't be able to do that because he's not now setting up to get the public financing even if he were to win an appeal. So he is forsaking that possibility, which means that it's hard to see a path to victory for him other than the fact that it's hard to see a path to victory for anybody.
We were talking earlier, Colin, about whether or not the RGA, the Republican Governors Association, jumps in with money in this governor's race if they find that the Republicans in Connecticut are able to put up a candidate that is electable. I guess that might pertain here as well to Joe Ganim, who may be able to raise money, may be able to get some people in the cities to vote for him in a primary, but I don't know that anybody in the Democratic Party necessarily wants him to be at the top of the ticket.
No. I mean, talk about a nightmare scenario, and that is a nightmare scenario. And I don't think it's a completely far-fetched scenario, too. I mean, look, first of all, we should say, we keep talking about the Citizens Election Program as this kind of overarching kind of ball and chain on candidacies. By my count, there are six people who are not seeking funding through the state. It's Stefanowski, Stemmerman, Guy Smith, who's still in the race, he's a Democrat, Joe Ganim, who can't get it, Ned Lamont, and Oz Griebel, right? All of those people are not seeking public grants. They are, to use Liz's term, raising money the old-fashioned way. And you can raise a lot of money the old-fashioned way, and there aren't as many rules about how you have to do it. Now, with Joe Ganim, one of the things that I hope everybody's sort of watching carefully is how he does raise this money, because obviously the people who want to do business in the city of Bridgeport would have tremendous incentive to give him money. That might not be the best thing for the common wheel. So just keep an eye on that anyway.
Here at NPR have started to, look at some of those fundraising numbers. I know I've talked with Patrick Scahill here about some of that. The Ganim thing is interesting. You know, you make a good point, Colin, about where that money comes from. But I think the competitive part of that is important because, you know, for candidates who go outside the public financing system, they have to, and this is true of candidates at all levels, they have to be able to demonstrate, I think, that they can be competitive in a general election financially, because no matter what, the state is going to kick in $6+ million in a general election on, you know, middle of August to a candidate that's qualified for those grants. So you need to be able to compete with that because, you know, when you have cash on hand and how much that you have is going to have a significant factor in your ability to execute a successful campaign. So, that's the process stuff of this that I sort of like to, you know, sort of drill down on is like the where and the when and the how, because, if you're David Stemmerman, for example, if you're the nominee, you need to be able to demonstrate to voters that you're going to be able to have a competitive war chest to a Democrat candidate who may get a state grant, and vice versa. Joe Ganim's going to have to be able to demonstrate that he can be competitive against a candidate. Let's say Mark Bowen is the nominee, and he's going to have $6 million come August. You know, how are you as a candidate going to be able to compete with that?
Right now, setting money aside, it may be a good point to make about issues and the substance of the campaign. In the event that you have Boughton against Lamont in the general election, Boughton is going to do a sudden turn and it's going to become the most centrist, leaning liberal, nice guy candidate you've ever seen on August 10th or whatever the Tuesday, Wednesday is after the primary. And Lamont is taking a risk right now by positioning himself really, really, really strongly in the wheelhouse of the base. That is to say, on the solid left. We saw that on Friday at the AFL-CIO convention.
Progressive left.
The progressive left. Call it what you want. The progressive left, the leaning left, whatever it is. He's not hedging his bets, and that's why he won overwhelmingly by 3-1 over the next candidate at the AFL-CIO delegates convention.
Is Ned Lamont really in a general election? Is he really the liberal pro-labor guy that he needs to be right now in order to court support from the base and from unions? I mean, he's been part of a couple statewide campaigns already, and I'm not necessarily sure that it proves out that way, Dan.
I wouldn't have. Well, in the campaigns he was in, he was running against people who had some pretty good labor credentials, or at least in the way distant past Lieberman did, and certainly Malloy did in 2010. This time around, he'll be running against somebody who's perceived as anti-labor. I would have thought that your fear for him would be correct until I saw his performance Friday. He's really, really, really saying the right things in what looks like the right way. Other people are as well in the party, and other people are good. I think the labor is going to do what they always do, which is line up behind the Democrat no matter what.
But if I don't know, in a general election, to Dan's point, Colin, if you are going to align yourself so closely with the labor movement, if indeed one of the things that either a Republican or a Democrat is probably going to have to do at the state level is figure out how we're going to pay for everything, including maybe some hard negotiations with labor. I mean, I don't know how this plays out for Ned Lamont longer term.
I think you'll see a pivot similar to the one that Danny described if Mark Boughton were to win the nomination. That's typically what they do. I mean, look, there's two kinds of candidates. One of them has consultants who are pretty carefully, you know, focus grouping certain positions, kind of seeing what works in the primary, what works in the general, helping the candidate articulate those positions in a really effective way that's on the money. And then there are some candidates who are just so diehard about their beliefs that they're very difficult for consultants to work with that way. I would put Ned in the former category. I mean, I don't see Ned dying on the cross for like a whole lot of ideas. You know, I think he probably is going to be pretty biddable, as they say in the dog training industry. You know, that if they tell him here's how you're going to do this in the general, you're going to have to pivot and move off some of this stuff that you said in the primary, I think he will listen to that. I think Boughton would too.
Well, historically, as goes the union, so goes the nomination for the Democrats. I mean, you see that play out in 6-10, and I think you're going to see it play out again. So the strength of the support from the AFL-CIO for Lamont certainly signals, you know, he could be their nominee. I'll take Aaron Stewart, Mark Boughton, to run down the list of all of our candidates against Ned Lamont and that sort of an agenda all day, every day.
Because who would you not want to run it? I mean, of everybody in the field, be honest now, as a Republican, who would you not want to have to run against on the Democratic side?
Who would I not want to run against?
Yeah, if you're saying you're going to take any candidate against Ned, and I get what you're saying, is there anybody that you feel differently about on the Democratic side?
No.
Okay.
I mean, I think that the one size fits all approach that Democrats have taken in Hartford and have had a, you know, bully pulpit controlling all positions of government in this state, including at the federal level. I think that what you're seeing, look at the SEIU poll that says the state is 73% of the electorate thinks the state is going down the wrong track. That is the highest number.
The SEIU poll also said that 48% labor unions have a 48% favorability rating as compared to – that's double either Republicans or Democrats.
Right. So this isn't a conversation necessarily about labor reform. I'm talking about the direction of the state. And by the way, if you talk to state employees who are having to pay higher taxes, if you talk to state employees who are looking at having to pay tolls to go to and from work, I mean, there are a lot of things that they don't feel the state is managing well, and they're having to pay for it. So I'm not necessarily sure that just because the union bosses get together and decide who they're going to support, I think that some of the union members who have the dues-paying members are going to have a different opinion, and they may not go all in lockstep.
If we're talking about union support, well, good support for Ned Lamont and his message. pretty lukewarm support for Luke Bronin, who wasn't even invited to address the group. I mean, what should we read out of this, Dan?
He was he was sort of an unfortunate victim of his stand on being unwilling to check boxes off. For example, are you willing? And I read every question. There were 35 questions or 39 or whatever it is. And they were black and white answers that they wanted without explanation. Are you willing to raise taxes on the wealthiest 1% in order to pay for important investments? And he's not willing to say yes because he doesn't want to be pinned down to, I want to raise taxes. Every other candidate answered yes to that question, I believe, except for Connolly, who got marked down on it. And so he did what you did, what you do when you apply for colleges. You know, you give all the long explanation, except that there wasn't a college entrance exam committee here. There was a union looking at checkboxes, so he didn't answer correctly. So he didn't get invited. That said, he's also being marked down, if you will, because of having to be a mayor squeezing unions. Those contracts that he got from all three major city unions call for 4 years of no pay increases plus squeezed health care and tighter pension rules.
Right. His path, Luke's path to victory is does not go through the same towns, does not go through the same ideological tunnel that Ned Lamont is going through right now. I mean, if he has a path to victory in securing the nomination and winning the general election, it would be to run a little bit against public sector unions. That he would probably be that kind of candidate anyway. So we should say also, just so we're not, you know, precluding people and stuff like that, I think that Jonathan Harris and Sean Connolly are the only people who've actually qualified for the citizens election program on the Democratic side. I could be wrong about that. That was last time I knew. I don't think Susan Bicewicz had gotten there yet.
Luke is at 230, which means he's in shot. So he'll have it in the convention.
So Luke's going to make it. But, yeah, I mean, so all these candidates are still in play. Guy Smith, similar to Stemmerman and Stefanski on the Republican side. Guy Smith, this guy from Greenwich, is putting his own money into the race. He's not going to the convention, which he says is rigged.
It's rigged for people who might win.
Right, yeah. So, as I said to John before the show, it's sort of like saying there's too much pushing in the NFL, you know? I mean, yes, of course it's rigged. It's a convention. That's what they are. So anyway, there's some other candidates floating around. And similar, I mean, you know, the Republicans have kind of a little bit of a different problem with multiplicity. But when you've got all these people who are at least theoretically viable, including Ganim, it's hard to really have these dispositive front runners where, like, just nobody's going to beat Ned, you know?
Can we, before we move off of Luke Bronin too far, you've written about the big Hartford bailout that we've addressed on the program a couple times. This is essentially Luke Bronin, who's also a candidate for governor, you know, going to the state and asking for a lot of help in refinancing the debt of Hartford. I mean, two things, Dan. I mean, how does this play into this election that we're watching here, and how does it play in at all at the state capitol right now?
Mayor Bronin did a really, really good job for his constituents in getting that contract that guarantees payments for the city's general obligation debt for what could become up to 30 years and up to $900 million. The point they want to make, which I believe, is that that doesn't mean it's that much extra money over that time. If you look at the regular money Hartford gets over 30 years, it's billions and billions of dollars anyway, rightly because of pilot, because of payment in lieu of taxes for non-taxable property. But the problem is that it looks really bad, and it also looks bad because it was never debated in the legislature, quietly was put in a provision. We knew about the $80 million bailout. Quietly, there was put in a provision that said the state can negotiate with the city if it goes under this oversight board any contract it wants, and this is the result.
Yeah, so and to my point, in terms of somebody who's running for governor,
doesn't help him.
It doesn't help him at all.
If
he's courting support from outside the city of Hartford.
I failed to finish the sentence. He did a really good job for his constituents, and he didn't do himself any favors as a candidate.
He's actually not a candidate. I mean, he's still in the exploratory phase, and
that distinction more than I do.
Well, but because I think there are a lot of first of all, elections enforcement recognizes it because he's not actually declared he's a candidate. It also gives him the out so that if he's not getting the support that he would need to win a convention or to be competitive, that he doesn't actually have to run. I think that's an important distinction.
When you go around to 169 Democratic town committees and you ask for their vote, and when you raise $230,000, I'm sorry, you're a candidate.
Well, then he should be.
You're running for governor.
Then he should be, you know, an announced candidate. But I think he's trying to play it safe so that he can, you know, sort of say, well, you know, I've got to back out. I think what's interesting interesting, though, as you see that Senator Looney and Representative Ritter, you know, are quick to understand that they have to, you know, clarify what this means. And I think that Senator Fasano and Representative Claritas have done a good job of sort of saying, look, that's not what this was. This is a 2-year budget, and those are the commitments that we made were a 2-year commitment. And if you're going to extend it beyond that, then we're going to fix it.
I want to just take a quick break here because we have to address one more thing before we hit the break. We are on Facebook Live today, and so we're getting a little bit more Facebook, Twitter than chatter than usual. Ed Duncan is on Facebook. He says, I can actually understand Colin McEnroe. Maybe I need a new radio. So he must be watching. So Ed likes it. And Judy Cook is wondering if Dan Haar is drinking scotch or bourbon. That's a question maybe we'll answer.
It's his own urine. It's an Ayurvedic thing.
A quick question for you, Colin. We had a gubernatorial debate for the Democratic Party. It was out in Brookfield. I was watching Facebook, actually, and saw my friend Al Robinson, who follows politics out in that part of the world. And he had a very interesting video of one Lee Whitnam, who we periodically bring up here, being dragged forcibly from the stage of a Democratic gubernatorial debate.
You kind of have to. I mean, I know Lee Whitnam is a huge problem, and she's, you know, obviously connected to some pretty anti-Zionist sentiments in a way that can often sound pretty anti-Semitic, too. I think you have to love her spunk. So what she did, I think, is she just showed up on stage and she put a sign up, like where the name signs were, and she stole Joe Gadam's chair, and she was just going to sit there. And apparently, she did this successfully in East Hartford too.
She did. I was there. Yes.
Yeah. So she's done this once before. I don't know if I wanted to like cause a lot of trouble for myself, I would sort of build on Dan's comment and say, how come Peter Lumaj gets to go to debates but Lee Whitnam doesn't? But I'm not saying that. I will not say that.
I just heard you say it.
But so I don't know. She can always be provided, counted upon to provide some excitement. And I personally enjoy that, but I'm a little bit of a chaos puppet.
It is worth watching if you can seek it out. It's quite a moment. We're going to take a break.
She did use Wasserman Schultz as a verb.
She said,
don't you Wasserman Schultz me, bro.
Luke got Wasserman Schultz'd by the union there. So.
So can you use that in a sentence, Dan? Wasserman Schultz?
I Wasserman Schultz in your general direction.
That's good.
He's, little Monty Python.
He's right verbing there. It. Dan Haar with Hearst there. Connecticut Media. Liz Karanowitz, who's a Republican political analyst. Colin McEnroe from The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. When we come back, we'll talk a bit about the 5th District race and also some national issues. There were a few this week in the wheelhouse. This is The Wheelhouse. I'm John Dankosky, talking about the week's news with Liz Karanowitz, who's a Republican political analyst, Dan Haar, who is from Hearst, Connecticut Media, and Colin McEnroe, host of The Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR. We're going to turn to a couple other issues outside the governor's race. Nicole Hockley and Mark Barden both considering a run for Elizabeth Estey's seat. Again, as we talked about pretty much all of last week, Elizabeth Estey, the incumbent in the 5th Congressional District, the Democrat, has said she is not going to run for re-election. Trying to figure out who might be the leading candidates. And between those two names, Colin and William Pettit, who currently is in the state legislature, also considering a run, this could make for a very interesting and very different type of 5th congressional race than we've seen in the past.
I had heard about the Hockley thing. I think I emailed you and our producer, Scott Breedy, sometime last week about it. And I said we really could have a race in which Dr. William Pettit and Nicole Hockley were the two candidates. I have to say, first of all, for journalists, I think this is going to pose an interesting set of challenges, because typically candidates are candidates, you know, and if they say stupid things, we say that they've said a stupid thing. If they do venal things, we say that they've done venal things, you know, et cetera. These people, because of the tragedies through which they have lived, you know, I don't think they're untouchable. And I think in some ways we might have to have a kind of a journalism summit in which we all try to kind of agree, you know, not in a way that's conspiratorial, but open about this. How do you talk about the candidacies of people who excite your sympathies in a very different way? Because ultimately, we have to be able to cover them as candidates, no matter how heartbreaking their stories are. We can't cover them as people with heartbreaking stories. They're people running for a very important elective office. They're seeking power. We have to be able to address that in a way that's not constantly apologizing for itself.
I wonder, I mean, we've had a little bit of a journalistic run-up to this, certainly considering Mr. Pettit, the entire debate around the death penalty that came and went a few different times, he was very much involved in that. And I think people had to cover that issue, and people on the political side had to talk on that issue, depending on how they view the death penalty in Connecticut, around and through what happened to him. Similarly, I think with Mark Barden and Nicole Hockley, who are, of course, co-founders of Sandy Hook Promise, we were very active in trying to find out as much information about what happened there as possible, trying to find out through Freedom of Information what the state knew and when they knew it. And that at times put us in conflict with that. So I think that there's a little bit of a back history of that. But I take your point. It's going to be hard to do, I think.
Right. And then ultimately, the other thing, the challenge to them is they have to run outside their own storylines, too. In other words, I don't think that you can run for Congress based on, these enormous life tragedies of theirs, they don't constitute a basis for ascension to Congress. So that's the other set of questions. Like, who else are you? We know you. I mean, we know a little bit more about Bill Pettit because he's been in the legislature now. But who are you besides this thing? And you're shaking your head. Why are you shaking your head?
I don't think it's fair to say we know a little bit more about Bill Pettit. Here you have a comparison between two people who have virtually no preparation to be U.S. congressional representatives versus a guy who went through a tragedy and had a long period of introspection before he entered the public, and B, decided he was going to start by going to committee meetings. And he's on the Commerce Committee and he's on the Appropriations Committee and he knows how the legislative process works and he happens to be a very good legislator. Now, that said, I don't know whether any Connecticut district, the 5th or certainly not the 5th, certainly not any of the others, would vote for a Republican to give Donald Trump a vote. But if it does come down to Nicole Hockley or Mark Barden versus William Pettit, I don't think it's a fair comparison because William Pettit has done the work to make himself a legislator, not a professional, a legislator. And I don't think that's a fair comparison. He's done the work. They haven't.
Well, it's interesting. I don't know if Dr. Pettit's going to run. I know he's been sort of thinking about it and talking with folks about what that looks like for him and his family, and it's a difficult decision. And you take nothing for granted when you're making those kinds of decisions. But it's interesting because I think that, the assumption is from some people that just because either Mark Barden or Nicole Hockley get in, that the nomination is theirs. And the sense I'm getting from folks that I've talked to is that that's not necessarily the case, that Mary Glassman would just sort of have to exit the nominating process because they get in is wrong.
Oh, yeah, no, I agree.
And so, I it'll be interesting for the other candidates, both Democrats that run in a primary against either of these folks if they get in. And I also think, there has to be a bigger conversation about the issues at play in this election, and not just one issue. So my advice on that would be to make sure that you know about what else is going on. I mean, it's okay to go as an advocate and be a single issue advocate.
No, it's not.
As an advocate.
But
to be a member of Congress, you're serving a population of people that are going to demand a lot of you, and you have to have an understanding of how the process works and how can you serve your constituents. So I agree with you.
And Danny, I just want to push back a little bit. I mean, look, both of these people have been on the national stage, not just the local. These are not people who are just well-known locally because of a tragedy. These are people who have funded and founded and worked towards change at the national level in a way that many people who have been in government in our state for a very long time have never done. That perhaps puts them in a different type of class in terms of their ability to step into a job like being a congressional representative. They have spent time on Capitol Hill, and many other people who are going to get into this race haven't been to Washington in a long time.
I think you can go too far the other way, and you can be too much of a professional legislator. And as I've said, I think that would hurt Chris Murphy if he were to decide to run for president. That is, that he's never run an organization. They have, and that's great. But there has to be a balance here. They've been advocates on one issue. It would be a mistake for the Democrats to line up behind them just because of the combination of sympathy and name recognition.
Yeah, but I mean, you have to be you sort of can't have it both ways. I mean, we've got a whole bunch of people running for governor right now who've never done anything in government at all. Bob Stefanowski, Dave Stemmerman, Ned Fred Lamont, really.
It's not just government.
No, but I mean, these are people who've made their reputations elsewhere. Steve Obsitnik. I mean, there's a whole bunch. They've made their reputations elsewhere. They are now saying, I have certain skill sets, which I think I can transfer into government. I would say the people at Sandy Hook Promise could say the same thing. We have developed certain skill sets and familiarities with how public policy gets made that we can transfer into government. I don't think they're any less plausible.
Advocacy on issues is what draws people into public service. I mean, you see a lot of candidates, you know, that run for local office that were part of PTAs and PTOs and that were engaged in issues locally that get them engaged in the legislative process locally, or they get to run for state legislature because of that. So being an advocate, it does qualify you to run for office. My point is that in the process, it will be interesting to see how other Democrats work in this process, because I think they're all, you know, they all Democrats seem to be on the same page on the issue that the Sandy Hook Promise folks are geared towards.
You recall William Pettit considered a run for Congress. Instead, he decided to work from the bottom, build and learn the trade. That's what he's doing. Mm-hmm. And I admire that. And I don't think it's a good idea to go the other way.
One of the things that happened this week, he finds out publicly or perhaps privately, and then later makes a public statement that there was a raid of the personal attorney, Michael Cohen, in his office. This is President Trump speaking earlier this week.
So when I saw this and when I heard it like you did. I said, that is really now in a whole new level of unfairness.
So this is President Trump, Colin. We only have a couple minutes left to get to one of the bigger news stories of the year. So his private attorney gets raided by the FBI. Trump is supposed to be speaking about a very important issue in Syria. He turns his attention to this. Is this a big development, or is this just another drip, drip, drip in this long Mueller investigation?
Well, the real answer is we don't know, because we don't know what they actually took away from that. But, I mean, signs point to this being a whole new level, to use his phrase, of something anyway. And the hoops that you have to jump through to do something like this. So what had to happen was that Mueller had to have some kind of information, which he then kicked over to Rod Rosenstein. Rod Rosenstein, the deputy attorney general who's in charge of all this, decided this was worth farming out to the Southern District of New York. Southern District of New York then had to go to a judge magistrate and get a very unusual kind of warrant. The warrant has to say that there's good reason to believe that Michael Cohen might destroy or conceal this evidence if he were given time. The warrant has to say that there's good reason to believe that some kind of crime was committed on the premises where you are going to conduct your raid. And then lastly, there's a whole bunch of hurdles you have to clear, which I maybe don't have time to explain, when you go after the documents of an attorney who is involved with a client. Everything about that, all the things that they had to do to get to this point when they made this raid, would suggest that we are on to kind of a new terrain.
And that's the important point that you make there, Colin. This is not a sort of a pro forma judge approving a warrant. This is a very unusual warrant in a very unusual case.
Yeah, and I mean, just very quickly, in terms of the attorney-client privilege thing, what they probably had to argue to the judge magistrate is what they call the crime fraud exception. If Danny's my attorney and we're doing legitimate things, then our attorney-client privilege prevails. But if I'm falsifying an affidavit and I use my attorney, Dan Haar, to assist me in that, if he's materially involved in my preparation of this false affidavit, then we don't have that protection anymore. You also don't have attorney-client privilege if you're not being represented in the particular matter. One thing that may have hurt Donald Trump, oddly enough, is when he said that he didn't know anything about this Stormy Daniels
stuff.
That's exactly
what I was saying.
$130,000 payment.
Exactly what I was saying. Michael Cohen at that point becomes a political operative, and I don't think that the judge had to ask or answer the questions about attorney-client privilege, because under attorney-client privilege, it's only if you are acting as the attorney. He clearly was acting as a political operative. Attorneys don't pay $130,000 to one's mistress without telling one.
If you're my tax attorney and I mentioned to you in passing over pad thai that I ran over somebody a couple of days ago, we don't have attorney-client privilege. You're not representing me
in that
matter.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the number of people who had to approve this raid by the FBI, they all know many of them are political appointees, and they all know that their jobs, you know, are in jeopardy if they do that. So this, whatever this is, there has to be substance there in order for them to pursue it. I'm not sure what the issue is. You know, so the first thing that came to my mind was is this an FEC issue? And that, you know, there were some folks who were concerned, I think, that the payment represented an in-kind contribution to the campaign that wasn't represented. And that can be problematic, as we've seen, that if you're using resources, business resources, or if you're expending dollars on behalf of a campaign that you don't account for it, then that's a serious violation of campaign law. So it'll be interesting to see what the jurisdiction is here and how it got through. But, you know, this is certainly something that,
I hear the music of a quick thought, Dan.
It seems clear that Mueller's investigation is very broad in getting into Donald Trump's finances. So that could be another area where this is involved and we don't know.
Dan Haar is an editor and columnist with Hearst Connecticut Media. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you.
Thanks to Liz Karanowitz, who's a Republican political analyst. Thank you so much, Liz.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks to Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR.
Thanks for not Wasserman Schultzing me.
We got out of here without really talking about Mark Zuckerberg, although
he sent
us a message on Facebook Live. He said we did a great job today, which I thought was nice. Scott Brady produces The Wheelhouse. Our executive producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks to Kion Wolf, Garnet McLaughlin, Betsy Kaplan, and everyone who helped with today's show, including Carlos Mejia, who put us on Facebook Live.